Hi everyone, it's Lauren and Ed. We're back with the Student Playlist podcast, and here's the vaccines. That was The Vaccines' Dream Lover from their new album English Graffiti, which is out on the 25th of May. So welcome to the Student Playlist podcast. Yes, we're back.
Hello.
This is the 23rd episode where we review the biggest and best new music released in April 2015 to back up our website, thestudentplaylist.com. So what do we think of The Vaccines?
Sounded a bit Arctic Monkeys-ish, didn't it? It sounded quite a lot like Do I Wanna Know, but you reckon it's...
Well, the vocals are so reminiscent of Ozzy Osbourne, of all people. Can anyone else hear that?
Yeah.
Obviously not the music, but just something in his voice is very Ozzy. I think that's quite cool.
I think it's good that they've discovered a slightly different sort of reformulation of their sound, because I had been concerned that The Vaccines were just going to kind of... one of these bands that weren't going to be able to move on and discover a new sound, or they'd end up alienating their own fans. But it's really encouraging for the new record.
Yeah, I like it. This is kind of Vaccines 2.0, and I like it more than the first version.
Yeah, Vaccines just a few more sort of bells on, basically.
Yeah.
So we'll be talking about that in the next podcast, and it's out on the 25th of May. But what are we going to be talking about on this show, Lauren?
Well, the albums that we'll be focusing on mainly... Blur's The Magic Whip, Drenge's Undertow, The Wombat's Glitterbug, and East India Youth's Culture of Volume. And other records out this month that we've been reviewing are The Mountain Goats, Waxahachie, Young Fathers, The Slow Readers Club, White Shadows, Villagers, Wire, Speedy Ortiz, Alabama Shakes, Passion Pit, Built to Spill, and Mew.
Mew!
Mew! Very exciting. Later on, we'll be...
I didn't sound very enthusiastic.
That's just me.
Yeah.
Later on, we'll be celebrating the anniversaries of some big albums that we can't let pass us by. Pavement's Wowie Zowie, which was 20 years old on the 11th of April. Guided by Voices' Alien Lanes, which was also 20 years old, but on the 4th of April. And Public Enemy's Fear of a Black Planet, 25 years old on the 10th of April.
News time.
Yeah, here's dun, dun, the news. Dun. Dun, 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 dun. Firstly, one of the biggest music-related pieces of news to rock the musosphere this month has been the announcement and launch of Jay-Z's Tidal streaming service. They're highly controversial.
It's subscription only, isn't it?
Yeah. So how does it work exactly?
It's basically Spotify, but you have to pay for it. He wanted to sort of level the playing field for artists whose income streams now basically rely almost entirely on live tickets and merchandise. I think a stream earns you 0.00084p or
Was
something.
Is that on Spotify?
Yeah, that's on Spotify and Pandora and Deezer and other streaming sites. So what he's come up with is an idea to, you got to pay, I think, $10. I think this is just going by US only price. I don't know how it translates in pounds. It's $10 for like basic and $20 for premium per month. And it's unique selling points, arguably, that you get video content, you get lossless audio.
Very high quality, that's the idea, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, and you also get curated, in inverted commas, playlists.
What does that mean?
You get artists saying what their favourite songs are, kind of things like that. But it's bombing, like, really, really big time. I mean, this was announced on the 30th of March, so it was a couple of days after we recorded our last podcast. Mm. But so it's not even the end of April yet, and it's hemorrhaging money. Kanye West has now disassociated himself from it. He's deleted all the tweets where he's mentioned it.
Wow.
He was at the launch alongside Jay-Z. It's out of the top 700 apps already on iPhones. So,
why has it failed, though?
It's failing because people like have become used to getting music for free.
Yeah.
Spotify was successful because it had deep pockets to start with. It was prepared to lose a lot of money on the way to making it successful. It's trying to enter a crowded marketplace, and people just aren't prepared to pay that much money.
The problem is,
Lily Allen was saying it's going to drive people back to pirating sites if it catches on, and it's not actually. So, have you had a gander at it?
Yeah. Well,
I shelled out some money for it just for a month, just to see what's on there, and it's, as far as I can see, it's for gullible star worshippers, basically.
Yeah, this is the thing when you have all the celebrities, all the singers, all the performers who were there at the launch were,
and there were loads,
hugely successful. So there was Madonna,
Daft Punk,
Kanye, Daft Punk,
Deadmau5.
Yeah, they were all rallying
Rihanna.
Around. But these are people who
Beyonce
live very ostentatious, decadent lifestyles. So we see them driving around in Lamborghinis and, you know, tons of bling, and it's obvious that they're very rich people. So the promise of artists being paid a fair wage,
it
seems
kind of
laughable in
that
context.
It was coming from the wrong people.
Yeah, because...
But then again, it needed that star power to launch it, though.
I don't think it did. If this had been a grassroots... Well, more, I'd say grassroots, but, you know, if it was a handful of smaller acts who'd launched it, I think it would have gained a lot more credibility. You know, if it was a handful of bands who were kind of vaguely well-known on the way up, who were trying to lift everyone else up from the bottom, then that would have... I think people would have bought it a lot more. But this just... It's been associated with greed, and probably wrongly, but that's how people are perceiving it.
It's a nice idea on paper, but there's been a number of artists who've just come out against it, like Ed Sheeran, for instance. I mean, Ed Sheeran and Taylor Swift are best friends, but Taylor Swift took all her music off Spotify, famously, and she's put it all on Tidal now. But Ed Sheeran's just refused to do it. Because he's also said, I owe my career to Spotify. I mean, he recently really reached 2 billion streams.
Wow.
He's only the second artist to do so. But Mumford & Sons come out against it. Lily Allen, Ben Gibbard from Death Cab for Cutie, they've all sort of written articles about, you know, criticising it and predicting its failure. It's easy to see why this would fail, but I reckon it's come too late. It's entering into a crowded marketplace. It doesn't stand a chance.
Yeah.
Not to say that it should. It's difficult to see why anybody would pay money for it, and you have to pay money for it. I mean, Spotify, you mean, there's like, it's ad supported free content, isn't it?
Yeah.
But if you want to pay for it, then you get rid of the adverts. That works. That's a business model that makes sense.
Yeah, people don't, you know, it's not, people don't aren't going out and buying albums for a tenner anymore. They're consuming music on a smaller scale. And if they can get things for free, then they will. That's just how it works. You can't appeal to people's sense of morality because
people
are always going to choose to do the things that are free.
People love their money more than they love their favourite artists.
Yes.
And I think they've forgotten that.
Yes.
Anyway, I would say check it out for yourselves, but you have to pay money for it. So, one more bit of news, I think.
Well, we've... Slightly more central, localised piece of news. We're talking about Live at Leeds now.
Yes, this is a last call for Live at Leeds, basically.
It's next weekend, is it?
Yep, it's the first bank holiday.
Yes.
2nd of May is when all of the sort of fun is happening. That's when like the 184 bands are playing around the city.
So who have we got? So
they recently added Reverend and the Makers to a list that includes the Cribs, Palmer Violets, Swim Deep, Carl Barat. I mean, we've been through this on previous ones. There's Eagles, Hookworms, who are two local bands. Slaves, M&EK. Yeah, Thurston Moore's on.
Stornoway, Spectre.
The guy from Supergrass, Gaz Coombs, is on it. Childhood. If you go onto our website, Matthew Langham has kindly put together a 5 bands you must see at Live at Leeds.
Oh, that's good.
From his recommendations.
What did he go... Well, actually, no.
There was a... He went for... Gaz Coombs was like the big one that he went for. I mean, he loves Supergrass, so of course he was going to go for that. Get onto the studentplaylist.com and find out what we recommend.
Indeed.
Albums time.
Whoop, whoop. So the biggest album that you won't have failed to notice this month was Blur's release, The Magic Whip.
Yeah, it's not Well, it's going to be out when you're listening to it. It's out on the 27th of April.
Currently streaming on iTunes.
Yeah. But yeah, but for your intents and purposes, it's out now. It's probably going to be number one by next weekend. We've got a clip of There Are Too Many People. There are too many of us. That's plain to see. We all believe.
That was There Are Too Many People from Blur's new album, The Magic Whip. And as you can probably guess by the title of that song, the whole album was influenced by the intensity of Hong Kong.
Yeah, which is when they recorded it.
Basically, they were on the way to a festival in Japan. It got cancelled and they thought, well, let's just bum around in Hong Kong for a few days.
Yeah, so yeah, they basically hunkered down, came up with some ideas. And then they gave it the bones of the album. Then they fleshed it out with a couple of sort of jams from Damon Albarn's laptop that he'd had sort of lying around, and that was sort of put together by Stephen Street, who is reunited with Blur for the first time since 1997. Obviously, you'd probably be aware that this is the first Blur album in 12 years, and it's the first with Graham Coxon in 16 years. So this is kind of, it's the whole gang back together again. It's classic
and
Blur.
And they've managed to pull it off.
So given the nature of the recording, you'd expect it to sound a lot more disjointed than it is. It sounds so just accomplished and planned, and it doesn't sound like
very
they knocked
slick,
it together, did
very
they?
Smooth.
Yeah, it's beautifully produced. I mean, we reviewed Damon Albarn's last solo album, Everyday Robots, but I think it was about this time last year it came out.
Yeah.
It was our top one. It was in the top 10 of 2014, and I think we both noticed it shares a lot of like the same themes as that record, like social dislocation as a result of unsustainable population growth and inhuman planning processes. I mean, the clip you just heard was There Are Too Many of Us.
Even though Coxon is said to be the driving force behind it, it sounds like he's been underused. That, you know, all the more aggressive art rock style guitars aren't really there, and that's kind of his trademark.
Yeah, well, you have to remember the nature of his departure from Blur back in 2002. He's very conscious that he's got to dovetail with the rest of the band's processes. So, yeah, it's a compromise between what was sort of like the settlement of 1997, where Damon Albarn was aware that for Coxon to stay in the band, he would have to let it sound a lot more art rocky, because Coxon hated being in a band that played country house. So, but because of the nature of the split, Coxon knows that he owes Blur something, and he owes Albarn something. So basically, he's made a record. He's fit himself around Blur and Albarn's writings, not the other way around. And there is like a really innate catchiness to this. It sounds really modest and quite downbeat, but only after two listens, I feel like I really know the album, like back to front and inside out. And this is all testament to Albarn's songwriting. You think, oh, this isn't going to stick. This doesn't sound catchy. And then you find yourself, it's in your head a few hours later. So yeah, it's got the same themes, and it does feel like a companion piece to Everyday Robots, and that's a really good thing, I think. I mean, I didn't really have that high expectations for this. I mean, even if they'd just done a pale retread of Park Life, it wouldn't have diminished them in my eyes, or in the eyes of a lot of Blur fans. I think it just, you know, a victory lap would have done. But this is actually like a really, really valuable addition to one of the best sort of back catalogues in the last 20 years, with the exception of one track, Ghost Ship, which sounds a bit too sort of reggae. It's that's the only one that doesn't really linger in your head. I'll say straight off the bat that it's my third favourite Blur record out of the eight that they've done.
That's high praise.
Purely because of the consistency that's in here. It just has that feeling of four mates back together again, and they're all pulling in the same direction for the first time in 20 years. Basically, it's an unmitigated triumph. 8 out of 10. I think it's a really good record.
Sweet. Very nice. nice.
And it really could have been a hell of a lot worse. It really had the potential to be a disaster, I think.
Yeah.
But it's a success. And I hope it gets to number one because it deserves it.
We're going to talk about Drenge's new album, Undertow, next. But first, here's a clip. We can do what we want. Balaclava on my boyfriend's head. Like you said, we've got to get away from living like the way we've been bred. Or no one took them like a bat on the back of the head. We can do what we want. We like Bonnie and Clyde, but without any pride. We're going to make out of the shootout on the day that we thought. They put our names up in lights. We put our lives on the line. We can do what we want from Drenge's new album, Undertow. Feeling very lively after that song.
Like that? Yeah. Finished.
Good video too.
Yeah. This is the second album from Drenge. They were a two-piece of Owen and Rory Loveless from terrible Derbyshire town. Just like really kind of boring and grey. They added a third member called Rob Graham on bass recently, and it's added quite a lot of depth and breadth to what I think was a direct but slightly shallow debut that they released. It was very sort of unidirectional.
Isn't it one of your best albums of the year?
It didn't make our top 50, no. Of 2013. But I've always felt that two pieces like this tend to struggle to project their power in other directions without losing the essence of what made them so popular in the first place. So they tend to make really good debuts, but then they kind of struggle to move on because they don't have the instruments to make that different sounding records. But getting a new bassist in, it's solved the problem. You get the same kind of mosh pit igniting onslaughts that you used to, but now it's rooted in a greater variety of sort of other sub-genres. Like grunge and post-punk, drone rock.
Didn't you say psychobilly as well?
That yeah, very psychobilly, like The Fall and The Cramps. That sounded a lot like, I think. In addition to Rob Graham, I think this is also down to a guy called Ross Orton, who's on production. Now, he produced AM by Arctic Monkeys, which was one of the best albums of 2013. And a lot of people praise that for it sounding a lot harder and sharper as a sound. Mm. It sounded a lot more vicious than what they'd used to, and he's done the same with Drenge. It just sounds more active, like a call to arms, whereas that debut was sort of dripping with boredom and apathy and ennui at their sort of boring teenage years, and now they now sound a lot more active about it. Owen Loveless still has his like weary, disaffected baritone sound, doesn't he? He still sounds like he doesn't give a shit, but now the music sounds a lot more urgent. I mean,
it's more shouty.
There's a track called Have You Forgotten My Name and a track called Never Awake. They sound quite like Nirvana, actually, sort of in utero Nirvana, with that kind of Albini, really sort of hard, sharp, sort of thrashing sound. I mean, I really didn't think this was going to be any good, and I'm more than happy to eat humble pie for having doubted their potential. It's just that so many bands in their position kind of fluff their lines, like Peace, for instance, but this is a really good follow-up to what was a solid but ultimately unexceptional debut. This has got a lot, I think it's got a lot potential to last in people's minds. Mm. And it's exactly the kind of logical sonic progression that we used to take for granted with bands and second records in this country. I mean, just as a kind of a side point, when did we start lowering our expectations for what a band's second album should sound like?
Mm.
Because now we kind of demand more of the same with a second record, and then we get surprised when they don't shift on for a third one. But this is what used to happen with bands and guitars, and it's refreshing. It's an old fashioned sonic progression, I think, and it really works. So 8 out of 10, one of the albums of the month, definitely.
Another very strong offering there, but will the Wombats live up to Blur and Drenge?
Right, so this is a clip of Give Me a Try from the Wombats' third album, Glitterbug. My necklace on underneath, and I don't care why. This apartment's always cold. London can try. It'll never swallow.
just heard Give Me a Try from the Wombats' new album, Glitter Bug.
Yeah, we did. So, all the cards on the table right away. I hate the Wombats. I despise them from the moment they came out in 2007.
Yeah.
That I hated that kind of ironic, kind of student-y, giggly thing. It was 2007 was their debut, A Guide to Love, Loss and Desperation. They followed up with This Modern Glitch in 2011, where they kind of tried to go all slinky and sleek and electronic in their sound.
As everyone was doing at the time.
Yeah. So this basically continues the trend. They've kind of already made their progression, and now they don't really know where to go from here. So it's just very, very surface level and uninvolving. I mean, we were just watching the video there, which was quite entertaining.
It was, they riffed on the whole Tinder thing, so Give Me a Try. They had different people looking at their phones, and you know, it was just showing all the people on Tinder with the different personalities and hobbies and things. It was really entertaining. You should check it out.
Yeah, but it was entertaining, and you didn't really notice the music going on in the background.
No, it didn't.
Because that's kind of the level of involvement you need to have with the Wombats. I mean, with lyrics that. They have lyrics that would like to think of themselves as being really incisive and like skewering modern life with like rapier-like wit. But actually, it's just things like, okay, sample lyric. Sometimes I like to go uptown where flashy people flash around. It's extortionate and I don't care. You can taste the pretense in the air. And that's from a song called Your Body is a Weapon.
Yeah, good rhyming there.
It's a song that thinks it's being self-deprecating, but it just sounds and it ends up being sort of kind of sexist and leery at the same time. I mean, getting lost in the middle of the in-between is another thing. I mean, it thinks it's really smart, but actually it's just really sort of skin-crawling. No, learn how to write songs. And you're just willing it to be over. I mean, musically, it's all really one-dimensional. It's designed to fill 1,000 capacity venues sponsored by mobile phone companies that sell gassy, watered down beer. There's no sense of disbelief that's being suspended, no sense of art, there's nothing at stake. It's pure commercialism to sell tickets, to sell t-shirts, and it's incredibly, incredibly depressing to listen to. This is apparently a top 5 album. I mean, Matthew Langham reviewed this for the site. I mean, he gave it 2 out of 10, and really, it deserves no more than that. I mean, I wanted to hate this, and I do, but not as much as I thought. And in a way, that's worse, because there's nothing specific to hate it for. It's just generic, watered-down bullshit that characterises 80% of what now passes for the British indie scene. We were world leaders at indie music, and now we're just being rapidly overtaken. Even Australia are now miles ahead of us with a much smaller population. I mean, I want to be angry about this, but I'm not. I'm not angry at it. I'm angry at what has led to it. I mean, it's British music fans deliberately lowering their horizons, and this apparently is now good enough.
Well, indie music was built on a healthy foundation of swagger that was reinforced by good music. You know, made you want to dance and think, I suppose.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's just swagger.
Well, this isn't even swagger. It's just very shiny and surface level, and there's nothing behind it. I mean, it's music for people who don't really like music. I mean, the mindset that I reckon you must have to be in to part money for a ticket for the Wombats in 2015.
Haven't you seen the Wombats?
Ages ago once, when I reviewed them. I mean, they were so obviously a passing thing, even back in 2007, but it got to number 5. I mean, why? Who is buying it? Please expand your horizons, whoever is buying it. I mean, if you were a teenager back then, you must be 23, 24 now. Buy better music. Oh.
Says Ed.
Yes. Sorry, rant over. I didn't want that to be personal, but people are responsible for this.
Lastly of the 4 that will be...
I promise you we won't slag off the next one.
His face has gone red. All that rant needed was a big gah at the end. So the last of the 4 albums we'll be looking at in depth today is East India Youth Culture of Volume, and here's a clip, Carousel.
Carousel, carousel.
that was Carousel from East India Youth's second album, Culture Volume. We were just watching a video of that.
Yes.
What did you think?
Which, the Carousel video?
Yeah. No. The video.
We saw a live video and East India Youth were going at it with the synths. And I went off on one, which Ed found hilarious. But I'll just, in a nutshell,
I was so angry.
It just annoys me so much when it's a recent thing. They didn't used to do this. But whenever you go to a gig nowadays and there's some kind of synth or drum machine, maybe a bit of laptop music that doesn't really require much hand or finger movement. You know, you just got to hold down a few notes, perhaps tap a few things gently, maybe even hit play. But whoever's doing it, the modern musicians, it's totally an East London thing. But they're there, like, headbanging, bopping their head to the music as if, you know, like, they're holding a guitar or something, or playing some piano concerto, just to... It's overcompensating to make it look like they're playing some super sophisticated instrument. Yes, there may be good music coming out of it, but the stuff people... It's like...
What do you expect them to do? Just stand there completely statuesque? I mean, if you haven't got a lot of money to spend on a backdrop or lighting, then, yeah, you've got to try and make some spectacle out of it.
Seeing
a musician getting involved with his music, yeah, they've got to do it.
But it's almost like they're keeping time or something, and it just looks so unnecessary and stupid, because they've got, like, this tiny little drum machine that's barely bigger than the size of the palm. This was completely encapsulated by Disclosure's performance at Glastonbury last year.
He does have a bass guitar, though, this guy, strapped round him all the time, so...
Just gets my goat.
Well.
It's so... You know that hipster song that came out a few years ago that was on YouTube that everyone was sharing at one point, where it goes, I play synth, we all play synth, and there's like a line of people on synth. It's just like that. That's what music is nowadays.
Wow, that's a Lauren rant there. You don't get those very often. Okay, so back to the world of the slightly more sane,
docile dragon awakens.
So yeah, this is their second album. It's the first since he got nominated for the Mercury Music Prize last year with Total Strife Forever. This kind of thrust him a little unexpectedly into the limelight when he was kind of plucked from like an anonymous mass of niche appeal bedroom music makers, like you say, in East London. But it had this like evocative quality to it of like urban loneliness and atomization, and it kind of reminded me of the XX debut, which gave the illusion of space through like a use of economy.
Definitely on that song Carousel, it's very reminiscent of Scum, you know, Tom Cohen's band,
like Brian Eno. I thought it meets straight off the bat. The only problem with that song is he sings in it. I mean, if it take his voice out of it, which isn't spectacular, that's a much better song. And this is the problem with Culture of Volume. I mean, while the first one was kind of a minimalist headphones album that you had to listen to by yourself or on late night public transport, this is clearly designed to be a pop breakout record. The music sounds like it's designed for much bigger spaces where the audience is focused on a performance, not on like on a dance floor.
Yeah.
It's brightly packaged in like a more immediate pop sense, and you can tell it's because William Doyle, the guy behind East India Youth, he sings a lot more on this, or he tries to anyway. But in doing so, he's trying to like spread the album's trying to spread itself over more musical territory, and it has a diluting effect on like the coherence of the overall album. So I think, while I think he's talented, what he's trying to do, and only partially successfully, is to make his voice the centre of attention, to like make himself a star rather than the music. And whereas on Total Strife Forever, if he sang, it was just like another instrument in the mix. It reminds me of what Tony Wilson of Factory Records tried to do when he tried to get Vinnie Riley of the Geruti Column to sing. I mean, it just detracts from what he's already really good at, if you know what I mean. That said, there is something to please everybody on the album. It is kind of nice and varied in terms of like the pace and the kinds of dance music that he's trying to cover. And he's trying to find his own voice and be original. But there's just too many moments here that they serve to disrupt the flow of the record. So it's like a boxer just not connecting with enough of his punches, if you know what I mean. So 6 out of 10, it's not a disaster by any means, it's just, it's not as good as Total Strife Forever. It's slightly disappointing.
So we're just going to briefly cast our eye over a handful of other albums. I'm not going to go into them as much. But Ed's going to basically give a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Start off with The Mountain Goats, Beat the Champ.
7 out of 10. If you're a fan of other Mountain Goats records, you'll like this. Actually.
Waxahachie's Ivy Trip.
I thought it was really excellent. 8 out of 10. I mean, she's a singer-songwriter from like New York and like Alabama.
There's a lot of love for this album.
Yeah. It just snuck into the top 100. I think it's like number 98 a couple of weeks ago. So not a lot of copies sold, but it's got great reviews and happy to add to it. Really excellent record.
Young Fathers, White Men Are Black Men Too.
The follow-up of the Mercury Music Prize winners, obviously.
That was quick.
I know. Yeah, they've not waited any time at all. 15 months it's been since that one was released. And this is just dead plus dead with bells on. It's just they've taken everything to, and turned it up to, as Mark Kermode would say, 11-ty stupid. And it's and it's very entertaining. 8 out of 10.
The Slow Readers Club Cavalcade.
Won't say anything about that. They kind of lashed out at me on Twitter.
Well, they didn't lash out on you.
Yeah, their fans did.
Ed posted this review of the Slow Readers Club album, and it was very verbose, articulate review. All back, you know, any negative points were backed up. He did say what he did like about it. He gave it a 5 out of 10. The band tweeted it and they said something like, "We've got to take the rough with the smooth." Fair enough. But then the fans leapt on it and started criticising Ed's writing style and stuff.
I created a Twitter storm.
Yeah, the miniature version of Beliebers.
Yeah. Yes, Mancunian Beliebers. Let's move on from that.
White Shadow's Secret of Life.
This is Craig Nichols from The Vines sort of side project that he's done along with Nick Littlemore from Empire of the Sun.
Oh my God.
It's as terrible as you'd think from Craig Nichols.
See, I wouldn't think that would be terrible. Craig Nichols is awesome.
Craig Nichols is terrible. He's been writing the same two songs his entire career. That said, this is different, and that automatically makes it the best thing he's done in a decade. But 4 out of 10, really, really dreadful in many ways.
Let's move on. Villagers, Darling Arithmetic.
They're twice Mercury nominees with their first two albums, and this, I reckon, is probably going to get nominated again. Very good. Matt reviewed it, gave it 7 out of 10.
Wires, self-titled Wire.
14th album, post-punk legend return, 6 out of 10.
Speedy Ortiz, Foyle Deer.
I thought this was really excellent. This is a recording nom de plume for a girl called Sadie Dupuis. She lives in Massachusetts. This is the third Speedy Ortiz record. It's like a cross between Sleater-Kinney and Pavement. If you really like your US indie, you'll love this record. It's really got really intelligent lyrics and complicated but not inaccessible music. 8 out of 10.
Alabama Shakes, Sound and Colour.
They're back. Mm-hmm. I was quite surprised by this. It sounds very different to the original. I mean, the original was good, but it was kind of record collector rock, wasn't it?
Mm.
You could have been concerned that it wasn't going to be able to do too much more with what they were using, but it uses all the same reference points and it sounds really different. It's all really downbeat and kind of designed for summery festival sort of mid-afternoon sets. There's no scuzzy garage punk involved. It's all kind of like slow Led Zeppelin kind of blues. It's good. 7 out of 10.
Passion Pit's Kindred.
Unabashed pop glory, 8 out of 10. Really good to hear him like happy as well. I mean, Michael Angelakos publicly been battling bipolar disorder, but he's now sort of settled his life down. He's got married, and this is it's the sound of a guy who's like really happy to have stability in his life. 8 out of 10.
Built to Spill's Untethered Moon.
Review not in yet. Matthew's doing this, so
okay, and that also goes for Muse plus minus.
You're really, really excited about this.
Of course I am. The Danish band, lead singles, rather good, kind of bubbly electro. If you like the melancholy Mew, you might be disappointed with this one, but we'll see. I have my fingers crossed.
It's pop Mew.
Yeah.
Fair enough. First album in 6 years, I think.
Exciting times. Classic album time now.
Woo.
Let's don our party hats and get ready to celebrate big anniversaries for some big bands.
Not so big bands, possibly, but what we got first?
pavements, wow.
I just think we're giving Guided by Voices a bit too much of a big up, considering very few people know who they are in this country.
Pavements, Wowie Zowie's first, was 20 years old on the 11th of April. While you reminisce, here's two clips, Grounded and Half a Canyon.
Doctors leaving for the holiday season. Got crystal ice picks, no gift for the gab. And in the parking lot.
Canyon, bro, you got this.
You just heard a couple of clips from Pavement's album Wowie Zowie, which was 2 decades old on the 11th. Can you believe it?
This was a bit of a strange one for Pavement because it was roundly criticised when it was released. But 20 years later, it's considered a minor classic by some Pavement fans as their best. I mean, we spoke about Crooked Rain last year. Which that was released in 1994. Critics and indie fans absolutely loved that record, and by 1995 were kind of looking at Pavement to pick up that kind of Generation X slacker rock thing after Nirvana kind of dropped the baton in 1994. So there was like a vacancy for like the new biggest American rock band, and a lot of people thought Pavement were going to be it. That Crooked Rain album had Gold Sounds and Cut Your Hair, which were pretty major college radio hits, but they'd not gotten any national radio airplay. But the coverage they got, basically, momentum was all in their favour, and everybody thought, right, third album will cross them over and break them big. But how did Pavement respond? They responded with a very long 18-song sprawl full of experimental-sounding, half-finished-sounding songs that a lot of people just think was Pavement dropping the ball, you know, fluffing their lines. They sounded aloof on this album, kind of like they were just messing about in the studio, but like they weren't really interested in success. And people really, really hated them for it in 1995. I read an article about this, somebody who remembers it being out at the time, and he was like in a circle of his hipster friends, and when the subject came up, apparently they couldn't speak. They were so disappointed by it. They were so heartbroken. But now it's regarded success. Now, why should this be? Because usually critical opinion travels in the other direction. Usually an album with such expectation hinging on it like this, or Be Here Now, they get praised on release, don't they? But then they quickly figure out, oh, actually, it's not that good. So which explains why The Great Escape and Be Here Now have these amazing critical postings, but actually people regard them as rubbish. This travels in the other direction. Now, I think it's because Stephen Malkmus, their Pavement's lead singer, he's basically casting around for a new language to express himself in. This is certainly the most sort of Malkmusian Pavement record that there is. It sounds most like his sort of post-Pavement career with the Jicks and all that. I think that in 1995 there were also a number of other sort of excellent alternative rock records that were just sounded more immediate than this, like The Bends, for instance. A lot of people in America took that as like the next big thing instead of Pavement. So also Electro Pura by Yola Tengo, that wasn't a success, but it's critically speaking praised. And the album we're going to talk about next, Guided by Voices, released Alien Lanes about a week before Wowie Zowie, and the critics loved that. So I think that explains why Wowie Zowie was overlooked at the time, and people were so disappointed. They thought, not only is this a disappointment, there's other bands with better records out there. But the kind of the rough edges and the joyous abandon that you hear on Wowie Zowie became loved as time went on. I think it's because its perceived weaknesses became its strengths later on, because of the relatively conformist nature of their next two records, Brighten the Corners in 1997. I mean, it could almost be a Travis record. It's so smooth, such smooth sounding indie. It sounds nothing like this at all. Terror Twilight in 1999. They got Nigel Godrich, the Radiohead producer, to make that with them, and that sounded a lot more mainstream. So Pavement didn't fluff their lines with this, but they really didn't want the success, the bullshit that comes with it. And Maltwins was just getting bored with having that weight of expectation. And so Pavement did the kind of thing that it's an album that artists make to remind themselves that they're still artists, not commercial juggernauts. And I think that's how you explain Wowie Zowie. It's on Spotify. I recommend getting the deluxe edition if you can find it. It takes a bit of work to get into, but some Pavement fans think it's their best. Not me personally, but certainly their most interesting.
Next up, as you might already know, we're going to be talking about Guided by Voices and their album Alien Lanes, which was 20 years old on the 4th of April. Listen to this clip first. It's called A Salty Salute. This on the sex list. The new drunk drivers have hoisted the flag. You just heard A Salty Salute from Guided by Voices' album Alien Lanes, which is also 20 years old.
Yeah. So now we've gone from the quite obscure to the actually obscure. the reason I'm talking about this is because it's symbolic of what was going on in the United States underground scene in the mid-90s. There was, for the anyone who doesn't know who they are, they're a band from Dayton, Ohio. They've been around since the mid-80s. Led by a guy called Robert Pollard and a couple sort of faithful lieutenants who sort of stuck with him all these years. They specialise in very, very short songs, sort of sketches of songs that sound deliberately lo-fi and improvised. There's been nearly 20 Guided by Voices albums and a Robert Pollard solo career, and so Pollard is therefore believed to have something like 2,000 songs copyrighted in the United States. I mean, the guy is just... He writes like somebody doodling on the back of bar napkins and then just sort of
throw them
away and discard them, you know, just moving on with somebody who's just never satisfied with what he's just done, and he's got sort of a restless imagination. So Alien Lanes was their eighth album, following a year after a record called B-1000, which we covered really briefly last year, which, after a decade of kind of slogging around the national underground circuit, finally got some national press attention. It was in the sort of top 10 lists of like national rock press publications for the first time. So their record label Matador advanced them $100,000 to make Alien Lanes, which is a huge amount, absolutely unheard of for an independent record label in the mid-90s. But Guided by Voices responded kind of like Pavement did with Wowie Zowie. They kept everything kind of the same for their fans. They just had, again, they had no time for the with the bullshit that would have come with trying to break them nationally. Rather than risk alienating what was an established and very, very loyal fan base that they'd built up over 10 years, to have actually played the major label game would have, like, they'd have come out with some slickly produced and probably doomed attempt at national radio airplay. So what they did is, it feels like a companion piece to B-1000, and many Guided by Voices fans associate this record very closely with its predecessor because they do sound really similar. You've got 28 songs in 41 minutes on Alien Lanes. It's punchy, catchy guitar pop that feels impromptu, improvised, and sort of live in the studio. Just like, again, like they're messing around in a demo studio, but that approach perfectly complements Pollard's writing style. It's got everything to do with classic pop and indie, but nothing to do with like the surface level, again, the bullshit that comes with trying to make it as a rock band. The Strokes were massive fans of these. They did a cover version of the song you heard, A Salty Salute. That was a B-side for Reptilia, I think. And they also starred in the Strokes video for Someday as well. Do you remember that? It was kind of a it was a Family Fortune style game where the Strokes were on one side, guided by voices on the other. So it's sad to say it's someone else's video is the thing they're probably the most famous for, like the thing they've been most exposed in. But guided by voices have influenced pretty much any band who's ever wanted to do something just for the love of music, and their prodigious output. You know, like I said, he's written 2,000 songs or something like that. 20 albums in 25 years, that kind of thing. They're like an American version of The Fall in that way. They're an institution, not a band, for those that love them. They split up in 2004. Then they got back together again in 2012, released something like 4 albums in 2.5 years, and then split up again. So, who knows? They might get back together someday. But they've got a vast back catalogue, as you can probably appreciate, but Alien Lanes is probably the most accessible thing they ever did. It's like the way in to their back catalogue. And they've also got a best song called Human Amusements at Hourly Rates as well, which is worth tracking down. That was everything they did from 1985 to 2004, condensed into a record. So they're a band I love, but I don't expect anyone else will. That many other people love them. They're an obscurist sort of a curio band, but they're really worth getting into. It's so rewarding. That's what we're going to do next, Lauren. We're going to fight the power.
Fight the power.
Fight the power.
With Public Enemy and their album Fear of Black Planet, which is 25 years old. That's a quarter of a century, don't you know? Sound of the funky drummer. Music hit your heart, cause I know you got soul. Listen, if you're missing, y'all, swinging while I'm singing. Hey! Giving what you're getting, knowing what I'm knowing, while the black band's sweating in the rhythm I'm rolling. Rolling. Gotta give us what we want, gotta give us what we need. Hey! Our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power.
Crazy
fight the power, man.
Crazy PE.
Public Enemy, Fear of a Black Planet.
Yeah.
It's old.
It is old.
Not as old as you, though.
Yes, skip that over. So, Fear of a Black Planet was their third record. Followed an album called It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, released in 1988. Generally considered to be one of, if not the greatest rap album ever made. You have to kind of understand Public Enemy and the influence that they had on hip hop. You have to understand it in. They had a similar effect that punk did on guitar music. They had a really sort of brutal basicness about them. Along with NWA, who were like a kind of a West Coast sort of equivalent at the same time, NWA were kind of like the Sex Pistols. They were like in your face, almost cartoonishly lyrical and sort of violent, singing songs like Fuck the Police, Gangster Gangster. It was designed to frighten parents and conservatives. But whereas they were quite crude, like the Sex Pistols, and only really had one great album in them, Public Enemy were like the Clash in this analogy. They were just as confrontational as Dr. Dre and all, and, you know, and his crew, but they were definitely more complex and subtle in deploying that attitude that they displayed. That is what makes what made It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, and it made probably. Made them probably one of the most critically acclaimed groups in the world. There's a great clip of their production team, the Bomb Squad. They're speaking in the year after It Takes a Nation of Millions, saying most people were saying that rap music was noise, and so we decided if they think it's noise, let's show them noise. So they just really went on for an all-out sonic assault, and it was breathtaking. And they continued the same thing on Fear of Black Planet. Just like 3 Feet High and Rising, which we talked about last year, Paul's Boutique by the Beastie Boys, and People's Instinctive Travels in the Paths of Rhythm from A Tribe Called Quest, which is also 25 this year, it dates from a time when you could still make ridiculously sample-filled music. It's a hurricane of influences and snatches and black pop musical traditions kind of all jostling together, densely layered.
Beastie Boys
stuff. Yeah, yeah. But there was the following year there was a lawsuit about a guy called Biz Markie, and it that laid down the rule that samples had to be cleared, and it made albums like this impossible to make because it was
unless
too much
Kanye West.
Yeah, unless you got too much, because there's just too much legal work involved, so you just couldn't have songs like this where there are 11 different samples in them sometimes. So you got hard funk, soulful grooves, Motown, dub reggae, breakbeat, all just in together, like sonic shards of sound. Just they're there for a bit and then gone in an instant. Thematically speaking, they're talking about exactly the same things they did on the previous record: police brutality, censorship, prostitution, the portrayal of black people in movies, women's rights. The kind of fear of the urban black population that you saw a year later with the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles. It's all in there. The album ends with Fight the Power, which is what you just heard, which is a 4-minute distillation of the album right at the end. It's kind of like it's their signature song, certainly their most well-known song. And that was the hit that Public Enemy needed to really break them big. I mean, Spike Lee, the director, hired them to record a song for his movie Do the Right Thing, which was nominated for an Oscar the next year. It's a musical middle finger to authority, just soaked in iconoclasm, vitriol, and that was the inspiration for the album. Unfortunately for Public Enemy, the American public got distracted because of Professor Griff, one of the band's members, making some anti-Semitic comments in 1989, the clumsiness with which Chuck D had handled the incident. He backed him, then he sacked him, and then he just disbanded the group entirely for about 2 weeks. And reference is made to that in the song called Welcome to the Terror Dome, which is on this. But after all that ebbed away, the group had reunited. The thing that nobody was left in any doubt about was that Fear of a Black Planet was another masterpiece from a band who were probably the most important in the world at that point. They weren't the biggest, and that was probably Depeche Mode at that time, which we spoke about last month. Along with its predecessor and others, like we were saying, late 80s golden age hip-hop icons like De La Soul, Beastie Boys, Tribe Called Quest, it's one of the very best records of its genre. In terms of influence, you can hear it in Wu-Tang Clan, Rage Against the Machine, Mobb Deep. In contrast to the kind of DJ Jazzy Jeff singles that people were buying, that was what rap music was associated with. By the mid-90s, you now had all sorts of politically aware, switched-on rap artists like Nas on the scene. And so they changed hip-hop in that way. They made it sort of angry, socially, politically aware. Musically speaking, all the bands I just named, plus Bjork, Ian Brown, Chemical Brothers, all sought inspiration from this record. And even 25 years later, it's the same kind of subject matter that you hear with Kendrick Lamar, Kanye West, Drake. And you can't understand these artists outside of Public Enemy's context. It's a living art piece, and Fear of Black Planet is every bit as relevant today as it was then. It's another masterpiece. It should be in everybody's record collection, along with It Takes a Nation of Millions. It's a 10 out of 10 record, anyone's books.
That was a beautifully impassioned tribute to...
Whew, a bit knackered now.
So, we're reaching the end of this month's podcast now. The May edition, which will be released in a month's time, will review in depth Mumford & Sons, The Vaccines, Hot Chip, Django Django... A lot of good things being said about that already.
Yeah.
And Brandon
Flowers, lead singer of The Killers, yep. Second solo record. So there's a lot of big old indie groups making new albums.
Be lots of exciting things to look out for. Meanwhile, on the site, make sure you look out for our reviews of Best Coast, Paul Weller, The OCs, The Fall.
31st album by The Fall.
Unknown Mortal Orchestra and Ash. And the album anniversaries that you should be keeping your eye out for over the next 4 weeks.
In our opinions.
Yep, are New Order's Low Life, which will be 30 years old on the 13th of May.
My favourite New Order album.
Supergrass's I Should Coco, 20 years old on the 15th of May. And Gorilla's Demon Days, 10 years old on the 23rd of May. Can you believe that?
More Damon Albarn stuff.
Mad.
I can't believe that's 10 years. That was like when I came to university for the first time. Feel that was good, like newly out.
Yeah, Feel Good Inc. may or may not have been the first single I bought. I can't remember if it was that or Weezer's Beverly Hills. I just remember going into
I hope it's not Beverly Hills.
It may have been. But that just shows, you know, been a music fan for 10 years.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
you put your time in.
Yeah, but I've only dipped my toe into the water, really. Mm. As usual, make sure you keep up to date with our rantings and musings on Twitter at Student Playlist and Facebook, of course, and on the website. Now that's
what's the website called?
The website is thestudentplaylist.com.
Yeah.
Now all that's left is for Ed to pick his albums of the month 1, 2, and 3. Go.
I like to think of this as bronze, silver, and gold. To be honest, we're sort of awarding, you know, what's it say on The Simpsons? Glorious gold, spectacular silver, and shameful bronze. So shameful bronze, Undertow by Drenge. That's a really, really good record. Not shameful at all in any way. Second, Waxahachie, Ivy Trip, like we briefly talked about. But first, you've guessed it, Blur's The Magic Whip.
Yeah. Yep. Awesome. Make sure you check it out and our website. And we'll see you again in a month.
Bye.
Bye.